The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in to what's going to be a very interesting program with our two guests today. First, a couple of quick announcements. For those of you who would like to call in today, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. And remember, we don't use call screeners, so wait for us to answer the phone, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. I also will answer the phone during the break, and if you are calling and your call is applicable, I'll hold you over during the break as well. So again, 1-866-687-7223. Now for email, which most of you seem to prefer anyway, it is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Which is also our website, thespaceshow.com. So remember to check the website newsletter, which goes up after today's program. You'll see it on the right side of the show. And when the programs are listed in the upcoming show menu, also on the right side of the homepage, you can start posting comments or asking questions for that particular show. And then we can address them either before the show starts or during the program. So again, that's the upcoming show menu bar over on the right side. Check out the menu in the upper left-hand corner as well. There are other links and items of interest there, including our store with Space Show t-shirts and things of that nature. Do remember that our program archives every single show on the website, and you can easily download those programs, and you can share them with other people. A typical show is 25 megabytes, which is a pretty big file to send by email, but we use WeTransfer.com to do that, or you can just send people the URL where the show is located. And if you're going to download the show, it takes maybe a minute and a half if you have a high-speed internet connection. So if you have any questions or difficulties on that, do let us know. But everything we do is archived and made available also as a podcast. And podcasts are in Gigadial, are in iTunes, and a host of other places. We thank Gigadial for doing that. If you have any podcasting questions, make sure you get a hold of us at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember also that we are a nonprofit 501c3, so we stay on the air because many of you do support us and because we have sponsors. So on our homepage, you'll see our PayPal links for supporting us, as well as ways through your Amazon purchases that you can support us. And you can also go to OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, which is our home organization, our parent, and you can find out a lot more about our nonprofit and what we do. And we thank you for your support, for without it, we would not be doing the Space Show. So remember, we are trademarked and copyrighted, but you, as I said, can share our programming and send it to people over the internet. There are only a couple of rules, and one of them is don't do anything commercial with these programs, and also don't edit them, and don't put cuts or clips up on YouTube or any other website, including your own, and we don't permit written transcripts, at least not at this time, and that's true even if it's for your own personal use. And we thank you for following through on that. You can read our copyright statement at the bottom of all of our website pages, including the pages at OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. If you have any questions, please, please get a hold of me before you do something that causes a problem. And we really appreciate that. And as I said, we do have sponsors from time to time. Check them out on our website. They have banner ads going across our homepage. But the first portion of our show today is brought to you by a couple of sponsors. So one of them is Celestis, which is the premier space memorial organization in the world. And their message for today is that in June of 2012, their latest memorial spaceflight was carrying the ashes of about 320 people to orbit, and then it entered Earth's atmosphere again, blazing like a shooting star in a final tribute to those on board. The flight began earlier with a dramatic nighttime liftoff from the Cape. The launch location for Celestis's next Earth orbiting mission is scheduled for liftoff later this year. People on the 2012 flight included Mercury 7 astronaut L. Gordon Cooper, James Doohan of Star Trek, who played Scotty, and hundreds of other people from various walks and lives around the world. While the 2012 mission orbited a little over a month, the next Earth orbit mission for Celestis is going to orbit for about 5 years, joining two other Celestis spacecraft currently orbiting the Earth. Space on board is limited, so if you have a loved one who would like to be remembered this way, contact them, Celestis.org. And AIAA also is one of our sponsors, and that is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, which is the world's largest aerospace professional society. They have over 30,000 engineers and scientists from 88 countries dedicated to the global aerospace profession. They convene 5 yearly forums or conferences. They publish books, technical journals, and the Aerospace America magazine, and they have a collection of over 150,000 technical papers, and they develop and maintain standards, honor and celebrate achievement, and do all sorts of really cool things with policy as well. They serve the aerospace professionals around the world and help shape the future of aerospace, providing tools, insights, and collaborative exchanges to advance the art of engineering and science for aviation, space, as well as defense. Check them out at their website, AIAA.org. And they're a great organization to be part of. If you're planning to go to Space 2016 in Long Beach in September, let me know. I'd love to say hello to you down there, because I will be down there. And that brings me to our program today. So we have two guests with us today. Their bios are up on the website, so I urge you to read them in full. If I read them in total, that would take up the entire first segment of the show. They're very impressive guest that we have today. But Rachel Tillman is the founder and executive director of the Viking Mars Missions Education and Preservation Project, which is a 501c3 nonprofit. And she began her path preserving Viking mission history when she was only 11 years old, when she saved the last remaining flight-ready Viking Mars lander from becoming scrap metal. Her early exposure to the mission came because she's the daughter of Viking team member James Tillman, who served on the Viking meteorological team and eventually became the final program manager of the mission for the last extended mission. And I do really urge you to read her full bio, because she has lots and lots of experience in communicating and promoting and doing the things that she is now doing with the Viking Missions Education and Preservation Project. But also with us is Al Trader, and he is actually a Viking alumni that worked in various aspects of the space and missile systems for 49 years, from conceptual design through development and flight. He tested and analyzed designs for Gemini and Apollo avionics early on, launched missiles in the Utah desert, and designed a calibration facility for Horizon sensors on a spinning communication satellite before going over to Caltech's JPL to work on the Viking Mars project as the orbiter maneuver analyst. He is also a member of the AIAA and a member of the AIAA Astrodynamics Technical Committee. Again, read his full bio. That's most impressive. And it's a pleasure to talk to you, Rachel, and to Al. Welcome to the Space Show.
Thank you, Dr. Livingston.
David, please.
Thank you, David.
Who knows what it'll be by the end of the show, but David is good for starting out. Rachel, what is the Viking Mars Mission Education and Preservation Project, and why?
Thanks for asking, David. The Viking Mars Mission Education and Preservation Project, besides being an extremely long name, is an organization that really came to be through a process of discovery, or shall we call in our geek language, gap analysis, As you mentioned, I was the daughter of Professor James E. Tillman, who was a scientist on the Viking mission. And so I grew up with the mission. I would come home from school or go to his office, and he would be talking about his problems or challenges or showing me new pictures. And so I was really infused with this incredible experience from my day one. And as a result of that, I really feel privileged to have a perspective on not just a mission to Mars, but on the entire process of how does a mission grow, what kinds of problems are people solving, what kinds of people work on these types of missions, and how does one get thousands of people, and I mean literally thousands of people, who are working on one thing to work together. So I heard my first terminology, the first term, Tiger Team, that I was later to use in the computing industry for many years through Viking. And what basically, when I was a young kiddo and learned how important this mission was, I found out that the Viking lander was going to be scrapped. And I said to my father at, you know, the ripe age of 11, "Hey, Dad, I'd like that." And he, of course, said, "Well, what are you going to do with that, honey?" And I said, "Well, we'll teach kids about Mars and robotics and discovery." And, you know, I was just an enthusiastic, geeky young kid. And he said, "Well, how on earth are you going to do that?" And I said, "Well, we'll build stuff." He's like, "What are you going to build it out of?" Because when you're a scientist, you're thinking of titanium and alloys and aluminum and weight and payload. And I said, "Well, we're going to use Legos and toilet paper rolls, of course." So that's what we did. We did acquire the lander, which is still under my care and is currently on loan in the museum up in Seattle, the Museum of Flight. It's on loan there for everybody to see. But we initially put it in my school so that we could, in fact, have kids in direct access to it. And so we started, I don't know if it was the first, but we started in 1979 these Lego robotics programs, quite literally, and there's photographs on our website of some of them. Back then in 1979, 80, 81, and that was through an incredible teacher that I had, Meredith Olson. She was the one that really made those things happen. I was a kid with crazy ideas, but people like her, teachers, and my father and Jerry Soffin and Carl Sagan and other people that would go out into schools, they made things happen. I really began protecting. I felt very protective of Viking, as I still do, and began gathering things as they were kind of headed for the round file, whether it was my father's documents or odds and ends, little pieces of hardware that would have ended up in the garbage. And I would ask my dad what they were, and then I would write little notes, and I'd stick them in my dowry chest, as it were. So really, I'd been collecting these things for a number of years. When my father retired, we had kept all of the project documents in his care that people had then forwarded to him as they end of life their role in the mission. A lot of that went to my father, who was the last program manager on the mission. And so we had these documents, and it was really important that they not be thrown away. And so I kind of did an assessment of who might lead an effort like this, and I called museums across the country, from the Smithsonian to the Museum of Flight, where we had our lander on display, and learned about how these things are cared for and what does it take to teach the world about a mission such as Viking. And then I went to libraries, because I've always thought that librarians should know everything. And I kind of did a little litmus test to find out what librarians knew about Viking. And out of five or six different libraries that I went to, only one person knew about Viking. And to me, that was a travesty. And so then I did my due diligence to see what was out there online. And I found some wonderful content done by a few different entities, but very fragmented and not very deep. It was sort of regurgitated across the board, and it didn't really give you, if you were an engineering materials student or an astrobiologist, it didn't really give you in-depth information that was well-rounded. And so I decided, well, you know, we have these materials that we saved to do something with. We discovered that this effort couldn't be led by a museum, because museums typically have, you know, 10 to 5,000 topics to cover, and we wanted to this to be very much in-depth. We didn't want to do a light brush because Viking was too critically important for historic, scientific, and engineering reasons, along with other things like economic development. There's a lot of things that come out of Viking that are really, really important to share. And so we decided about in 2008 to lead this effort ourselves, and then I began the process of forming a team. And over since then, we've developed a team of incredible volunteers like Al Trader and many others. Hundreds of Vikings have joined this effort, so the people that worked on the mission themselves are supporting this. And we've been doing education outreach really ever since, well, about really mostly in the last 2 years. We've been, prior to that, we were really focused on interviewing, doing oral history interviews with Vikings and curating content. So we formed our 501c3 in a few years ago. I don't remember the precise year. I'm not really a year-driven person. And we've been steadily growing in support and content. And we have an incredible set of volunteers that work with us doing a variety of things. So that's the impetus and what we're doing now is we're sharing that through education outreach. And then on the back end, we're building digital interactive exhibits, a traveling exhibit that will go anywhere in the country and potentially beyond the borders. And we're also working to connect with the institutes that are interested in having their own Viking exhibits or that already do to upgrade them to be much more in-depth than what they are currently. Primarily, if you go to a museum and you see a Viking artifact, it's a static sign. So we're offering our resources and our content to all of the museums, whether it's the Smithsonian or the California Science Center. All these tremendous places, we're offering our content and expertise to help them upgrade those exhibits that they have already. And then we're also doing things like working with scientists and computer experts from the mission to actually restore the data on Viking, some of which has never really been processed. And then we're making that available in a format that is more easily accessible to scientists and students. A lot of the data is in PDS, which is the Planetary Data System. But a lot of it is in binary, which can't be processed easily by anybody. So we're helping to restore that data. As we gain funding for each piece, we then delve into it and work on restoring data for the purpose of scientific and continued engineering exploration. And then we're making everything available online in our digital, our online Viking Mission Museum, which we launched in January. So that's kind of a long mouthful, but or a long summary, but that's kind of what we're up to.
Do you take any position on Gil's work on his experiment in finding life on Mars, or do you just supply the data?
We don't take any positions. We supply the information. We're not scientists ourselves. Well, actually, that's not true. Some of us are, but the Vikings are really the experts of their material. And as an organization, we don't take a position, but we think that the work that Dr. Levin has done and continues to do is incredibly exciting. And we need that science to be out there because we now know things about the data that was gathered on Viking and the continuing body of knowledge that is growing from the subsequent missions, such as Phoenix and Spirit Opportunity, and Curiosity, and all of the missions that are ongoing as well. We're learning new things all the time, so we can go back and look at the data and learn new things from the Viking data. And in fact, there's a scientist that we're working with, two scientists that we're working with now that are doing just that. They're looking at the GCMS data and reanalyzing it, and they've found some pretty remarkable things. But I'm not that expert, so I really can't go into the detail of the science effectively, and instead we will make all that data available through our websites and our online mission museum.
And you have an event coming up in a couple of weeks in Colorado, correct?
We do. We do. And Al will be there along with many, many Vikings. And this is the 40th year of the Viking mission, so 40 years on Mars. And that's pretty darn tremendous if you think about it. In the 1970s, we managed to get there. And there have been amazing missions that have gone on since Viking, But 40 years on Mars is a pretty tremendous anniversary to celebrate. So we have been working with all of the centers and institutes that supported Viking back then, many of which have merged, so they've gone through multiple name changes since Viking. And we are putting on the Viking 40th anniversary, which is open to all Viking contributors all around the world. And so we do have, in fact, people flying from all over the place to Denver, Colorado, for a Viking reunion. And during the day, we're having a public outreach event so that people can actually meet the men and women that worked on the mission. And that's really critical. The party is to honor the Vikings, and that's a great celebration, but more than anything, we think it's important for these incredible people like Al and the many Vikings that will be there to actually be available to the public to answer questions that you and I can't begin to answer. So they get to hear it from the people who worked on the mission, and that's really important. So that's what we're doing July 16th in Denver, Colorado at the Wings Over the Rockies Air and Space Museum from 10 a.m. till 4 p.m. to put a little plug in. Folks can actually go and meet many Vikings that worked on the mission and Al, learn from them.
Al, when you worked on the mission, did you have any idea that it would have this type of historical significance years later, 40 years later, four decades later? Do we still have Al on the phone? Rachel?
Al, are you there? Or are you muted?
I wonder if we lost him. He hasn't sent me an email.
Okay.
Well, I guess I'll try to get him back on the phone and see, what happened.
Al, are you there?
Al, is that you? Hello?
I'm wondering if it's just a matter of a mute button.
I don't know. Then he should be able to hear us.
Yes.
I have to hang up on him to try to call him back. So let's see if he comes on in just a second. In your talking to people, Rachel?
If you'd like to make a call.
I guess that answered the question. I guess he hung up somehow. Are you still there, Rachel?
Yep, I'm still here.
Okay. In your working with people, did are people surprised that Viking has this kind of longevity and interest four decades later? And I'm going to try to get Al back on the phone.
Sure. It's for those people that are familiar with the Viking mission already, they're not surprised, really, that there is the interest because those people that know about Viking are in the aerospace community, and Viking is still used as kind of the system of record, if you will, for many, many different purposes. Because of the longevity of the atmospheric data that really was the longest up until fairly recently, that created a baseline of information that scientists and engineers have been referring to for subsequent missions to Mars. So among the Mars exploration and the space community, it's not really a surprise that Viking is still that standard. Additionally, things such as the sterilization and planetary protection, Viking really set the standard for those as well, with the sterilization of the Viking landers that has been not really matched with subsequent missions, because the missions that have been subsequent to Viking are really pursuing different objectives. And then the standards have grown out of the Viking standard. But, yeah, among the space community, I don't think it's a real surprise. I think that for people that are becoming newly acquainted with Viking, it perhaps is a surprise that 40 years later people are still interested. But then when they learn about the mission and the fact that, you know, there were multiple different scientific investigations as well as the engineering developments that came from Viking and then have been used in other missions, as they learn more, they recognize the significance of the mission. So
let me see if Al is back with us. Al, are you back with us? He answered the phone. Al, are you there? Well, he's on a cell phone, so I don't know. Maybe he's not. He's not holding the connection. I don't know. He answered the phone, and then I put him in through the mix while you were still talking. So.
Okay. He said he's here and was disconnected, but he's back.
Well, he's off the line now, so I have to call him back again. So,
okay.
I will do that. Let me take a break early. And
okay.
Let's see if I can get him back and get him stabilized. So, listeners, we're going to take our break right about now, and we will be back in, let's say, 3 minutes. And hopefully we can get Al and his cell phone back up correctly. And don't go anyplace. We are coming right back.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, listeners, and we do have Al on the phone, and so far so good, and hopefully the connection will hold up. So, Al, what I wanted to ask you when we started having this problem was when your team and you were working on Viking, did you have any sense that the project would live on 4 decades later and be so exciting and so important for people both who knew about Viking and for people who are learning about it for the first time? Did you have any sense of that?
No. I was, you know, I was in my mid-30s. I was a junior engineer, and I was just lucked into an interesting project that, and they told me basically, you know, what my responsibilities were. It was limited because I was just a junior engineer. So I did, you know, I satisfied more than my requirements. But in any case, all we did was work on interesting stuff and just glad we were. The historical sense, I think, is maybe it's unusual in younger people because we didn't seem to have it. We just were doing good stuff.
Did you know anything about Mars ahead of time, or it was just interesting that you got to work on something dealing with Mars?
Yeah. I remember I knew something, you know, like reading books and reading Ray Bradbury,
uh-huh.
You know, his stories about Mars, knowing it was fiction, but that was good. Anyway, what it reminds me of is we had precursor missions, like the finally had a Mariner that flew by Mars and was able to photograph it in some detail. And I remember my younger brother, who's got a PhD in physics, was questioning me about, have we finally determined whether or not there are canals on Mars? And it seemed like the pictures from Mariner proved that they were not canals. They were simply features that seemed to connect. So when you got closer, you could see that they were distinct features that were not connected. Although, I guess we found water channels on Mars. So there are water channels. It's just that Schiaparelli was not able to see them clearly.
Was Viking, did you work on, first of all, did you work on both Vikings, were you, or just one of them?
Well, they were basically identical. So, yeah, we worked on both of them. They were, JPL had, in this case, it was a more expensive project, so they sent two to make sure at least one would be successful. And we just, we supported both missions at once. First of all, we had to build software that was applicable to both for analyzing or creating commands for the spacecraft and analyzing the data that came back for it that applied to both of them. And then during the mission, we would take data and work with it, whichever spacecraft it came from, and build sequences for both of them.
Fascinating. So when you heard about this project that Rachel was working on, this had to be made for order for you and the other Vikings, correct? That
Well, you'd think so, although a lot of them are retired and just want to ski or other things. I'm not sure just how excited all these other Vikings are. I think they're retired and tired, maybe. But, yeah, for me, it was. I thought, gosh, here's something I can do where somebody's actually wants to spread the word. It's a fairly unusual thing. Most of the people that I know, their eyes glaze over when you start talking space stuff. But Rachel, ha-ha!
I have an email question from Jack, who is in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And Jack says, I'm wondering if you knew what the experiments were on Viking at the time, like Gil Levin's experiment. Mm-hmm. And were you looking and hoping that your missions would find life, or was that not a concern to you?
Oh, it was. As a matter of fact, this was maybe an unusual project in that the management tried to get the families involved. So we had family nights where they would explain these things, you know, bring your family in, even with the kids, wife and kids. And they would have presentations that would be applicable to lay people. And it was getting everybody excited. Not only that, it was also helping the families understand why their important parent had to be away from home at odd hours, which was happening more and more as the mission went on. So, yeah, we all got introductions as to what all those experiments were. And it raised our expectations that we're going to find out something everybody wanted to know. Is there life out there or not? So, yeah, we were prepped for it, and we were paying attention.
Rachel, were you prepped for it by your father?
Okay, well, I'll answer that in two different ways. I was prepped for it, but not really by my father. Interestingly, my father was on the meteorology team, and so what I learned from him was about the boundary layers and atmospheric pressure and very obscure things like that that an 11-year-old shouldn't normally know. But because I was interested in biology, I would ask all these other questions, like, is there life up there? And I think that, and so I would get those answers from people like Carl Sagan and Jerry Soffin. So the people that I knew as a kiddo, I would follow them around and, you know, ask them those questions. And so Carl and Jerry were really the ones that talked to me about, you know, the potential for organics on Mars. And I preface it that way because as an 11-year-old, I wanted to know about life because that made sense to me, and the word organics really didn't. But as a 50-plus person, and now looking back at the mission and seeing how we communicated about the mission and where some of the disconnects were, I realize now that we could have done some communication differently so that the expectations could be set differently. Because to me, the idea of having, you know, tiny organisms can be just as exciting as giant life forms. And yet the expectation was sent, you know, to kids was a little bit more ambiguous, and to the public in general. And so the public in general was thinking about life and without actually knowing what that meant. So, I think life in all its forms, and in fact finding a new life or organic form that we've never found on Earth would be incredible. And that's most likely what we will find whenever we do find something somewhere. It's not going to be anything like what we expect. So I was excited when I was watching the first image come down. I knew there wouldn't be little green men, but I had nonetheless spent the previous few months drawing pictures of what I thought Mars would look like and what creatures on Mars would look like, knowing about the atmosphere and stuff like that. So I was excited. I didn't care what it looked like. I was just super excited.
Were your pictures close? Not about little green men, but in terms of what Mars looked like?
Oh boy! Now you're asking me to stretch way back there.
And are they by chance on your website?
You know, I would say they are probably in some of the files. Some of them might be in some of the files we haven't actually gone through yet. You, keep in mind, we kept thousands of files, but I'm less focused on things that are about my childhood, which I do find in my dad's files fairly frequently, a drawing here, a photo there. But I tend to ignore those, and I put them aside, and, you know, if I find something like that, and I go on to the, you know, the design specs. So I don't really know.
But see,
I can't answer that very well.
If you want to outreach to young kids, mm-hmm. which you were at one time,
absolutely,
then showing these kids what you were doing when you were their age is really cool.
You know, you're absolutely right. I would say that we're doing that with other kids' art. So there are other children's art that was done at the time of Viking that we're actually putting up on our. We're creating a gallery of art that was done by kids during that era. I just haven't really included anything of mine in it, to be honest. It's really been focused on other kids. If I come across something, I will do that. I'll make that promise to you. When I find something of mine, I'll put it out there.
Al, what were you going to say?
Oh, I was going to say that Rachel better include her own stuff. But I also wanted to add that when that first picture started coming back on the monitor, I'm surprised that, Rachel, you were watching it come in, too. But it builds line by line because mm-hmm. that's the kind of camera it was. It was like a Xerox machine. You know, it just scans one line at a time in the scene and then builds it. And that data was coming down raw, and it was building on a TV monitor for everybody. And so it was line by line from the left to the right. And as it was building, we were trying to guess what it looked like, and it started to resemble, to more than one person, it looked like the Arroyo outside JPL, you know, the dry wash with rocks in it and stuff. It turned out that was just our imagination. Eventually, of course, it showed that it was a close-up, like it was supposed to be, of the lander pad and the surround, you know, very close to the lander. But it was funny that we all had that same thought. Geez, are they making this up? Is this just coming from outside the Arroyo? And then we realized, no, it was real.
Well, and it's interesting that you say that too, Al, because a lot of the studies for the geologists and the students that worked on Viking and the geologists from the USGS. There was a lot of work done then, and there still is, on what are the analogs? How do we, when we're going through the design process to land on the surface of another planet, how are we going to do that? So the engineers at Martin Marietta at the time had to design for these incredible ranges of possibilities. They didn't know if there was going to be powdery light dust, because the dust storms at that point were well known, or if it was going to be solid big rocks that would, you know, puncture the bottom of the lander. They didn't know that because we didn't have the resolution until the orbiters were actually in place. The Viking orbiters were orbiting Mars. So before that, the craft were ever sent up there, there was a lot of expert research that was done on different analog surfaces that might be similar. And so we've got, you know, the desert photos that, you know, are famous with Carl Sagan. We've got the Arroyo behind JPL. We've got craters of the moon. People were all over the place studying these different environments to figure out, if we were to land something here, what would we do? And a lot of heavy lifting, quite literally, was done, filling boxes and big areas with loose dust and different kinds of sand and different kinds of rock, and then, you know, dropping things on it to see what would happen to the materials. It was really an incredible journey that the engineers and scientists were on to figure out, how do we make all this work in a place where we have no detailed knowledge of what will be there. And in fact, we were pretty darn lucky that we didn't puncture the bottom of the lander in the case of two. So we were fortunate, and also incredible engineering that happened on the forefront.
Yeah, what I can say is they were intending to land on July 4th, you know, just like we're going to have the the orbiter for Jupiter going into orbit on July 4th this year. We are that was the whole plan. It was the big bicentennial of the United States.
Yeah.
And yet we didn't land until July 20th because they weren't quite sure that what they were able to see from the orbiter and measure from ground radar indicated that their planned landing spot was smooth enough. That was the big deal. So they actually delayed the landing from this, you know, supposed really best date to another date that was assured more safety. So that was the engineering involved in it.
I have another email, and it looks like this is going to be a day of emails rather than phone calls. Listeners, the phone number, come on, you're not at work today. Pick up the phone, 1-866-687-7223. So this is says, hi, we are Al Trader's siblings and family listening live. The program is fantastic, and we are so proud of the work you are doing. Question, what are we still learning from the Viking mission? Did we benefit more from the scientific advancement or the engineering or both? Thanks, and this is from Jude Trader Wolf.
Well, that's my sister.
That's pretty awesome.
Good for sis. And, well, what do you say to her question?
Yeah, I think it's the engineering, because we advanced in engineering. We learned a lot about how to organize a really complex mission here, that there were so many different entities involved, and we were trying to be careful and successful. Successful is very important. So I think we learned a lot about how to get such big engineering projects done. And then we went on from there, of course, because that wasn't quite we had advances in computing on board that were used in the next big project, Voyager. So there are things that we did in engineering which are simply learning experiences for the engineers. And then, although I still use a lot of the things I learned then, I keep using them, have used them over the decades in other projects, because it was my learning experience, and I got to know how to do some stuff, which was useful later on. But the technology advances. So the original Viking technology was a learning experience for us. We were successful at it, and we learned how to do better.
Did you expect Viking to land successfully, or were you expecting it to splatter on the surface of Mars? What were you truly expecting?
I really expected success. But I have to say that as I was listening in on how fast it was, the landing was taking place, of course, it had already taken place when we heard it because of the light delay from Mars. But
we
listened to it as if it were our real time, and it was coming in at such a rapid high velocity, because they gave us velocity relative to the ground and altitude, and I was mentally computing, we can't stop that fast. We're going to crash. That's what it felt like until we saw it really did start stopping that fast, and it slowed down until it was going pretty leisurely toward the surface. So I got to say, we originally thought it was going to be successful because that's how we worked. We worked hard for success, but then it seemed like we'd somehow screwed up to me. Other people were not so concerned. They realized what it was going to look like, what that final trajectory was. I just had never worked that part of it.
Well, I want to follow that up. That's an interesting, it kind of speaks back to what the other question, too, about whether it was science or engineering or both. But if you think about that in human terms, as Al said, we're all looking at this, it was 20 minutes of death as opposed to the 7 minutes of death, right, for curiosity, and which is kind of funny to me. Because we knew that the lander had done something, landed, crashed, whatever. Yeah. Yet we were waiting 20 minutes to find out what that something was. But what's interesting is when you see that, the mass of it, like Al was talking about, as a human, you're thinking, oh, my God, impact. That's what we're conditioned to think, right? Because that amount of speed, how do you do that? But what's really interesting is that, and I agree with Al, that the engineering was absolutely monumental and is one of the things that continues to be. But if you think about how that was successful, aero braking using an aero shell was developed, the aero braking with the Viking aero shell was developed in such a way that, and so successfully, that it's been used on many, many subsequent missions. And so you think about the expertise that went into that. And again, imagine the ranges of possibilities and the scenarios that could happen. Well, the what ifs. What if this? What if the parachute doesn't open? What if we enter at point X degrees? What if we get the insertion off just a little bit? All these different possibilities that would have made the mission potentially unsuccessful. And you think about the fact that both landers and both orbiters were successful, and both launch vehicles too. The Titan, with the Titan 3Es. That's pretty phenomenal. Essentially, six out of six were successful. But going back to what Al said about working carefully, Viking was designed from the very first days under the care of Jim Martin as an engineering project that was focused on, as Al said, success, but to a very interesting degree. And one of the things, the cultures that we've learned about, it's been phenomenal, and I think is a lesson that could be taken to other projects, not just in aerospace, and I know it is, but also to lessons for engineering anything. The top 10 problems. So today, we worry about talking about the challenges and the things that aren't going right. So we talk about all the things that are going great on the projects that we're doing. Not so on Viking. Jim Martin had a program called the Top 10 Problems, and those were things that were not working right. And what he did was he assigned experts and more people to those areas that were not going as expected in order to solve those problems. So on Viking, people were not afraid to fail or to talk about things that weren't going right. In fact, the opposite was encouraged. If there's something that's not as you think it should be, bring it forward. We'll figure it out. So it was this incredible sense of moving forward and growing knowledge that happened continuously on Viking in every single team. Now, the other thing that made Viking successful, I think, from an engineering perspective, was the fact that there were redundancies built into the systems. So from the research I've done and the interviews with the engineers, it's my understanding that every mechanical and electronic and computing system had three redundancies built in. Even to the wires on the meteorology instrument, there were three tiny micron wires that would actually be used to read, wind speed, temperature, et cetera, et cetera.
Rachel?
There was that kind of redundancy, and that's part of the success, yes.
Okay, I got callers wanting to get in to talk to you, so let me take a call, okay?
Excellent.
Hi, caller, who are you? Where are you? Welcome to the show.
This is Marshall, and really enjoying what you're talking about here. My question basically comes in is, how do you go and pick those engineers that are going to do the project when you know up front that nobody has a clue how to solve the problems?
That's a good question.
Good question. Yeah.
I can talk about how I got into the program. As it turns out, I was being laid off from TRW at the time. So I was happy to get any kind of interview, and I really wanted to work at JPL. Between Christmas and New Year's, JPL people typically take off. It's a holiday. But the people working to staff Viking, George Pace, was the supervisor of the GNC analysis group. He was still working through those holidays, and he asked if I would come up you know, for an interview. And as it turns out, they were looking for someone who had worked with hardware, which I had been doing, had also worked somewhat with analysis and wanted to do analysis. So with hardware experience and wanting to do analysis, I was a kind of candidate. So they want to talk to me. And I think what may have convinced them, unless they just really needed somebody, was I asked them a question that startled them somewhat about, you know, how they were designing this guidance and control system. You know, why do they do one axis at a time instead of both axes? You could get the same rotation done quicker. And they had to really stop and think. So I think they did answer the question, and I won't go into that because that's too technical. But as a matter of fact, we do a single-axis rotation now, but it required computers on board. It was not possible with the simple electronics that we had available then. Anyway, I think it was because I was able to, talk at their level, basically, that they hired me in. So maybe that's kind of how you got to take chances when you invite someone for an interview, and maybe you find someone that rings with you.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'd like to follow that up, and Al is a great, you know, I'm so glad Al is here to answer questions because he's also a great example of what made Viking successful. In all the interviews I've done with managers, and that goes all the way through the Viking Project office, and you've got to think that Viking was built in phases. So it was conceived of as an idea, and then it was initiated and proposed by a number of different groups around the country at different NASA centers. And then the Viking Project office contract was won by Langley, the Langley Research Center. And so when you think about any project, there's going to be a culture that is set by the leadership. And the Langley Research Center was filled with folks that had been doing research and development. They were people who were used to solving problems for the first time and being incredibly creative and not being risk-averse. So I think that there's really a few things that I can think of, three things. Curiosity, and this is something that has been supported by managers that I've talked to, that the people that they wanted to work with were people who were incredibly curious and creative, so they were very much thinking out of the box. They were incredibly rigorous, so they were ready to beat themselves up and be beaten up by a panel of their peers saying, well, what about this and what about that? And in addition to that, so the curiosity and the rigor, but also the lack of sort of a fearlessness, if you will. So if you're going to do something for the first time, you've got to be willing to try a lot of different stuff. And you've got to be willing to watch it fail so that you can learn from those failures. When they were testing the parachutes and the landing vehicles, the BLDT, they were dropping things out of high altitude and then seeing what the actual impact was like and learning from that. The people were able to sit and do calculations and ask the right questions. So the people that the team was looking for, Iz Tabak, Jim Martin, Tom Young and others, the team that they were building were people that were going to be able to figure out how to ask the right questions. And another point that Al made, that he demonstrated actually with his question, was that the people that they hired largely were also able, they were an expert in something. They really had incredible detailed knowledge in one thing, but they were also multidisciplinary. So there was a lot of crossover between the groups on Viking. They needed to understand not just how to compute and analyze, but they also needed to think about, well, you know, how is this going to affect the other groups? What's the integration piece going to look like? So there was a lot of interdisciplinary skills, and I've heard that with all of the Vikings, and they don't tout it themselves. Honestly, they're an incredibly humble group of people, But listening to them talk, they'll say, well, you know, I was thinking about this physics experiment, and then I applied it to this design of this mechanical device. You know, they were incredibly bright people, and most of them were handpicked for the mission, and Al was probably handpicked, I would say, as well, so for good reasons. So that's what I've heard from the management, just to answer that question.
Marshall, anything else?
Oh, well, I could follow up with a fun statement, but it'd probably take too long. Let's try this. How do you teach college engineering students to basically be willing to hang their toes across the leading edge of technology and not get scared?
You know, that's an excellent question, and it probably would be a long answer from both Al and I. But one of the reasons that we formed this project was because we want to help students to learn to think the way that the men and women who worked on Viking thought, because it was successful and because it required the types of skills that you're probably looking for in those students. How do you ask the right questions? How do you not be risk-averse and to be? How do you be brave and work to solve unusual problems? So.
Yeah.
I could add to that.
So I'll listen offline.
Thank you, Marshall. Go ahead, Al. Go ahead with your response.
All right. Yeah. What I was going to say is, I have seen more and more evidence that the way in which even high school and middle school kids are being taught is probably in the right direction when they form these teams to solve a problem and probably have a product. Like a little rover that does something, or something like that. Talk to the astronauts and get them to do an experiment for them. You can watch it on video. That sort of a thinking process, you know, where you get together, you have you create an objective, you think through the problems, you talk to each other, and if it's done in a team effort, you get to learn how to solve things that are not otherwise, even a single person, is not likely to solve. I remember that was when I was an undergraduate, it was an innovative program at Marquette University. It had one class called Engineering Methods, and it went on for several years, where we did various strange things like that, just off-the-wall sorts of questions and what can you come up with? So I think the answer about how do we educate kids is being addressed and is probably happening.
Does it then get crushed when they find a manager who's pretty risk averse?
Of course, yes.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
You have another.
Oh yeah. And that you find all the time, yes.
You have another caller on the line. Go ahead, caller. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, David. It's Andy Chaikin.
Hi, Andy. Nice to hear from you again. How are you?
You too.
I just wanted
to say how excited I am about the upcoming anniversary event. And I was a Viking intern. I was an undergraduate intern on the Viking mission.
Woohoo!
And it was a spectacular experience. And you know, I've written about the Vikings in my book, A Passion for Mars, and I think one of the most important things I learned from talking to people about how Viking was done was a comment that was attributed to the project manager, Jim Martin, who said that what you need to be successful on a project like this is proper paranoia. In other words, you've got to be scared blank, I won't say the word, that it won't work. And that attitude, ultimately, it sounds counterintuitive maybe, but you need to be afraid of failure to be successful.
Yeah, there's a parallel in the space station that I could add, where we were given, when Boeing took over the integration of the space station, one of the things that we were given was, it was reorganized under Bill Clinton, and we were given a tentative design, and part of it was using GPS antennas in an array to determine attitude. A GPS is used for determining location and speed, but it could also be used for position determination. And I was asked, that was part of my responsibility, so I would continually be asked, is it going to work? Because it had never worked on anything except maybe a ship, you know, at sea. Is it going to work on a spacecraft? And we were in a very bad environment. The spacecraft we're going to try this on is full of reflectors that make it difficult to determine orientation from four GPS antennas. But it was not physically impossible, and I could never tell anybody that it was not going to work. And we actually made it work. It was very difficult. It was supposed to be cheap. It turned out to be very difficult, and nobody ever wants to use it again. But we did make it work on the space station, and it was one of those things where you kept wondering. There were people that kept asking, are we going to be really fried here? Should we?
And it reminds me of the comments that Jerry Soffin made to me, and he, of course, was the project scientist. And he said he was convinced that they would be lucky to have one of the two landers successfully make it to the surface in one piece.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
And when both made it, he was almost overjoyed beyond comprehension, you know. My God, they both worked, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think the thing about Viking is it was kind of the unmanned equivalent for Mars exploration of Apollo. In terms of its difficulty, I mean, having to bake every component in that spacecraft at a couple hundred degrees for however many hours, a day or more, for the sterilization requirement, I mean, that put unbelievable demands on the ingenuity of the engineers, the quality control, and pushing the state of the art. Anyway, I just wanted to say how great it is that Rachel has been doing all this work to capture the stories of the Vikings and to bring everybody's attention to it, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, we're,
so thanks,
we're
guys.
Very excited that Andy and Al and a lot of other Vikings from around the country, Bill O'Neill and Don Crouch and Ed Euler, and there's a whole host of Dr. Ben Clark, lots of folks are going to be meeting in Colorado, and the really cool thing for me is standing back and watching all of you talking to the public and sharing your stories with the public, because the way I look at it, for every one of you, there are, you know, 25 kids out there in the world that can have the dreams that you had and make those things happen. And if I can facilitate making it happen by getting you all together, that's a win.
Yeah. Andy, do you have another book coming out?
Well, I'm working on a book for NASA on principles of success in spaceflight. And Viking is one of my flagship examples of how to be successful doing these incredibly demanding missions. And it all comes down to how we think about the work and how we behave. And, you know, there are just too many stories of people who thought they had it all together and had it made and got a little bit too confident.
Yeah.
And these are the lessons of history that I'm telling in this book. I'm going all the way back to Apollo and putting down a framework for success based on the attitudes, practices, and behaviors that got us to the moon. And then I look at the subsequent programs in that light. So it's different from anything I've done before, but it's very exciting, and I'm looking forward to being out in the world with it once I get it done, which should be sometime in the next year.
Well,
and
keep us
you'll
posted,
meet a lot of folks at the event.
Sure,
and
sure will, David. Thank you.
That will add to your content, Andy.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that, Rachel. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Oh, it's going to be wonderful.
Thank you, Andy. Good
take
to hear
care,
from
guys.
You. Bye-bye. So, listeners, the line is available, 1-866-687-7223. I have other emails for you both, okay? So this is from... I'm looking for the one from Sweden. Hold on. Here it is. So this is Bijan, who's in Sweden. Were there any serious plans for follow-up robotic missions to Mars at the time of Vikings?
Yes. Yeah. The
yes.
answer to that is definitely yes. There were plans. So, interestingly, I have a series of reports from three different organizations that were all looking at follow-on missions to the Viking mission. And in fact, three of them, the three that I will be curating and putting out there after the event, nothing's going to happen before the event, we're talking about taking the Viking lander, the VL-3, which is the one that I own that's in the Museum of Flight in Seattle, and actually repurposing it as a rover. So there were a number of missions that were already in process being planned to go back to Mars and put treads and various other sundry types of mobility engineering techniques on the lander or something like the lander to follow up. And there's some, so yeah, there were three different groups at least that were well on the way to proposing those kinds of options. Martin Marietta was certainly one, and JPL was another, and Langley, all three of those organizations had proposals in the work.
And what happened? What happened?
That's a
lack of funding.
Well, but it's probably more than lack of funding, right? Something else came in there, I guess.
There's a lot of things that happened. A lack of funding is definitely one of the things that happened. But that's a long answer, I would say. And we're still uncovering things. So there's a lot of different opinions. So if you think about Viking itself, there was kind of a hiatus on missions to Mars after Viking. Part of that was
part of that was
due to the fact that the results as they were communicated did not satisfy everybody, despite all of the myriad of successes. Individuals that were in decision-making positions for funding did not truly understand, and this means government. I'm going to be quite blunt here. When you get far enough removed from a mission, so you're not actually in the aeronautics and astronautics environment anymore, you're just deciding what kind of funding goes to which government organization. There wasn't a clear understanding of what the successes were on Viking communicated. And as a result of that, there was funding was allocated to other things. And at the same time, there were other missions that were being proposed, and the Voyager missions, there were a lot of missions that were already in the queue, and so the funding went to those missions. And so funding is definitely a big part of it.
Al, you have a note from your brother, Ralph.
Yes.
And he says, it's important to know about and remember these earlier space efforts so that our future engineers and scientists can appreciate what went into the progress in space we now experience and enjoy. It's like standing on the shoulders of giants to help us see further in what's coming next. Al's and her contributions to Viking apply. They stand with those giants.
Hey, thanks, Ralph.
That's super sweet.
So John has a question for either of you. And John is in Toledo, Ohio. This is an interesting question. You would probably not have gotten this one yet. And John says, there is so much attention in the commercial space community today and the new space community into the rocket itself. Hardly a day goes by that we don't hear Falcon 9, Falcon Heavy, or some other rocket being developed by another company, or the giant Mars Colonial Transfer that Mr. Musk wants to build at some point. It seems to me the focus is disproportional on the rockets. So I'm wondering what your focus was back in the day on the actual rocket, or were you not so focused on that? Maybe you didn't have very many choices, so it wasn't an issue. But what part of the attention span did the rocket actually play in the Viking project?
Oh, if you're talking about what
huge
our job was, our job just assumed that, of course, we could be lifted into a interplanetary trajectory by somebody, and it was their job, and we didn't actually have to pay attention to that.
And if I can add to that, the attention then was actually huge. There was a prior proposal to go to Mars before the Viking mission that was called the Voyager mission to Mars. And one of the reasons that that was defunded was because of the launch vehicle itself. It was simply too large a vehicle with too little scientific return. So there was a period in which the rocket had to be reevaluated, and the methodologies for getting to Mars were actually reevaluated as well when the mission moved from a 1973 launch to a 1975 launch. So a lot of things had to be reworked. And the folks from the Langley Viking Project Office were the ones that initially had to say, yes, we can do this, because the window of opportunity was not going to be met because of funding and engineering timelines. And at one point, the mission planning director, Norman Krabill, who worked on Viking from the earliest days, was, and he'll talk about this, and he has talked about that in presentations, but they had to reassess how to get there with a change in, again, the change in launch date. And it was, he was told essentially that he would do that, and in fact he did. But the launch vehicle was a huge part of that, and reassessing it and changing it from the Voyager model to the Titan 3E was part of the success. And there'll be people in Colorado. Unfortunately, I'm not as much of an expert on that, but I'm learning. But there'll be a lot of folks in Colorado, and we'll have a lot more material to talk about the launch vehicle. It was, in fact, very, very important part of the mission, and that's part of what made Viking successful, without question. The launch and the propulsion systems were critically important. And the use of hydrazine, which was the fuel that was being used, and there was a lot of research R&D that was done on the fuel itself, because you were going to be landing on a planet in order to study the organics directly under the craft. So the hydrazine itself, the fuel, and the rocket, and the retro rocket engines for both the lander, there was a lot of work that went into both the landing and the launch vehicle and the propulsion systems to make Viking successful. And again, that's a really long answer, but there'll be a lot more data on that on our website. So
Helen is in Portland, and she says, David, please ask your guest if they think that NASA is too risk averse today.
I'm willing to answer that, although I might be sticking my neck out a little bit. I would have to say that the environment today is much more risk averse than it was than it was during Viking. But I also think that the scrutiny that NASA is under is much more intense. And so NASA has more than one challenge. They have a challenge to facilitate successful missions, but they also have a challenge to gain public support and explain what they're doing. And that's an incredibly difficult thing to do because it is so complex. Communications is something that is hard to do quickly when you're talking about rocket science, and yet the missions need public support in order to get funded. So over the years, NASA has become more risk-averse because the missions that have had challenges have been more publicized than the missions that have had successes. And that's a problem with journalism, to be quite frank. So NASA is addressing the problem of launching, you know, successful missions, but it's also having to deal with the problem of managing responsible journalism. And I think that makes it really challenging.
Good luck on managing responsible journalism.
Yeah. Al, would you like to add to that, please?
I mean, you'd be better off thinking you could land on Mars in a year than to manage responsible journalism.
Yeah, I would say, just as a comment on that, is every time that I've seen a technically written journalist, technical journalist, supposedly, if he's got the science column or something, and writes an article about something that I've been involved in, it seems that although it seems to be a story about what happened, almost every detail is wrong. So it's as if it were impossible for a journalist to actually write a correct story about science. I think they're given a correct story from the institution responsible, and then they rewrite it to make it more interesting from their viewpoint.
Yeah.
They think it would be more interesting for the readers. And then it turns out it makes everything wrong.
Yeah.
I've had my own experience with trying to publish an external document out of JPL, and we had a technical writer who worked for JPL and supposedly would know what he's talking about, and I would have to argue with him about every change that he wanted to make. He finally gave up and just let me write it the way I wanted it, because I could explain to him finally why he was wrong. He couldn't even change a prepositional phrase, and it would create an error if he did that.
Yeah. It's,
anyway,
it is very hard to communicate. Yeah, and I think that we try to do these light blushes of things, and there's also this expectation that there's more glory in certain things, and the glory could be that there's more glory in a launch or a landing. And this is, I hear this from all sorts of PR and marketing people at all the institutes I talk to. Well, we're more interested in the launch, or we're more interested in the landing, or, you know, and yet it's not the most interesting piece. What's fascinating are the details. How did we get there? How did you design and engineer to make that launch successful? There were millions of hours of hard work put in by engineers and scientists and academics in order to launch that vehicle. That's what's incredible. That's the magic. We need to refocus. I think we have to refocus on communicating those stories because they are that interesting. And when we see kids asking questions, we know that we're on the right track in terms of communicating what's more important. And so we're hoping to guide journalists to do more in-depth reporting and really talk about the stuff that matters.
You know, if something just occurred to me. There are retired engineers out there, like me, who are tired of seeing stories about technology and science being misconstrued and misleading the public. I wonder if the media would be amenable to hiring retired engineers and scientists to write something that's correct, regardless of what the editor thinks is important.
This is a joke, right, Al?
Kind of educate the retired engineers into how to make it more interesting, like Carl Sagan was always able to do.
This is a joke, right?
It's not a joke.
It's a great idea.
I'm just thinking of the editors and all of that. You know, I teach a commercial space class at the University of North Dakota in the graduate school, and this year, for the first time, I've added classes in on how to communicate and be involved with the media, because it's so bad. And I have a question for you guys that has come in from and the reason I don't want to say too much until I read the question, but this is what the two of us were talking about before the show started, one of the things we were talking about. And this is exactly what you guys are talking about with journalism and reporters and stuff like that and accuracy. So Sandra is in Tucson. And she wrote in and said, I'm not sure if you have seen the AP story from earlier today about China and their plans to go to Mars in 10 years, and they want to copy the Viking rover. So that must be an incredible compliment if that's what China wants to do with all their modern technology, is to replicate Viking. So I know you've seen it because I sent it to you before the show started.
Right, right.
But Al, I'll let you talk and respond to Sandra.
Yeah, I had to explain to my niece, who also thought Viking was a rover, and of course it was not. But it's just nice that they would talk about Viking, because that was the first time we successfully landed, our humanity successfully landed on Mars. The Russians had tried twice and crashed. So now if the Chinese can manage to land successfully on Mars like they did on the moon, it would, of course, be their historic moment, and it's good for them.
Maybe you can rent them VL3 so they can copy it and put wheels on it. What do you think?
I
think it's a tremendous compliment, personally. And, you know, I come from, since I'm not at any government institute, and I really appreciate the global nature of Viking as a mission, I think it's fantastic that that the Chinese are interested in learning from the Viking mission. There's a lot of things that are being learned from the Viking mission by the mission planners of today. I mean, as I said before, the aeroshell, the way that sequences are thought about, conceived of, because they had to be so incredibly resourceful. The parachute systems, the landing systems, there's so much about Viking that would be beneficial to the Chinese. I think that that's great, and I think it is a huge compliment. And I also believe that it's great when everybody is striving to achieve common goals. So,
I'm curious, you say you have possession of VL3.
Mm-hmm.
How physically big is the thing?
It's about, I'm horrible at sort of estimating.
10 feet across or so?
It's about a 12-foot round. If you're standing there, it's in a display currently that if you with a few feet of breadth between the outside barriers, that is probably about 15 feet in diameter, but it's about 12. And there are people that could give you the exact numbers.
Can you lift it up yourself, or is it too heavy?
No, I can't lift it.
So I'm trying to picture I haven't ever seen it other than in pictures.
Okay. So if you would imagine, what are those little tiny electric cars that you're seeing driven around the zip cars?
Yeah, I see them in San Francisco all the time.
Okay,
Fisherman's Wharf.
It's bigger than that.
Okay. Okay. So it's about the size of a bumper car.
No, it's bigger than
bigger
that.
Bigger than that.
No, it's
so
much bigger than that.
Bigger than a bumper car, okay.
Oh, yeah, much bigger than a bumper car. They're about 12 feet in diameter, but they were three-sided, so. So 12 feet in diameter, and they stand about, like when I'm standing next to my VL3, there are parts of it that extend that were unfolded. They were encapsulated, and they were probably 4 feet tall within the aeroshell, but extended fully with a meteorology boom and the S-band antenna. The S-band antenna extends beyond my height, so 8 feet, or more.
You have another caller on the line on hold. Hi, caller. Who are you? Welcome to the show, and where are you, please?
This is John in Fremont.
Hi, John. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, great show. I remember in high school when I had a paper route, I would clip out articles on Viking and save them. I was really excited back then, especially about the label release experiment. And I've read that there's some controversy around that, the results, about whether they really discovered life or not. I'm just wondering if your project, covers both sides of the story there.
Yeah. Absolutely, it's important. It's important to cover all of it, and I think if you missed a little bit earlier, we don't take sides per se, but we see that the results that happened, that Dr. Gil Levin's results were incredible, and gave us some insights, just as the pyrolytic release and the gas exchange and the GCMS, those all gave us really, really important results. And the thing to consider is that when you're designing a scientific experiment, you have to go up with a laboratory, if you will, we don't get to change it when it's in the launch vehicle and landed, but with a laboratory that's going to ask very specific and finite questions. So the labs on Viking, there were multiple experiments. There were three biology experiments and the GCMS, gas chromatograph mass spectrometer, which I can't say, so I always say GCMS. And those were various techniques that were looking for specific things. So we had to ask finite questions, and then we had to comprehend what the answers, what the results meant to figure out, to sort of try to conclude what that meant. And unfortunately, because we couldn't make changes, on the way, we didn't actually know a lot of things about Mars. We didn't know that there were perchlorates present. So we didn't know that the results on Viking might be impacted by the presence of perchlorates. Now we know more because of both Phoenix and Curiosity, and Spirit and Opportunity are providing additional data. So we're learning all the time about how to reinterpret that data. And I think it's incredibly important that all of the science has continued and that the momentum has continued, because there was a loss of momentum for a while, and it took some really strong people strong and brave people to keep it going. So I have extreme respect for Dr. Gil Levin, and I'm excited, and if we can figure out what those results actually mean with the additional data we're getting, I'm ready for answers. But we'll make all of that, all the information available, and scientists and academics can make their own conclusions. But I think it's good stuff.
Yeah, I'm sorry if you talked about this earlier.
No, I joined
the show late.
John Gill has been on the show maybe 5 or 6 times. You ought to go back and listen to all of his shows if you want to get his side of the controversy. He's very outspoken about it.
Yeah. He's got really great descriptions of how things worked. And again, I think it's we need to ask some new questions. We need to go back and ask some more questions. And I think that from interviewing with Dr. Gil Levin and also Dr. Klaus Biemann, who are both tremendous scientists, I think, and that's where, the public tends to sort of pit the results against each other. But when I spoke to both of them, they spoke about each other with extreme deference and respect. And the key is we need to ask more questions, and we need to send more instruments up to find out more data to answer the unasked questions. And that's the real key.
Great. Thank you very much. Great show.
Thank you very much. And listeners, that opens the line if you would like to call, and it is 1-866-687-7223, and the line is available. The museum in Seattle is both virtual and there's a physical presence where you can physically visit it. Is that correct?
Well, the Museum of Flight is a museum of on its own standing,
right.
And it happens that we are simply loaning the Viking lander to the museum to display.
Okay.
And so it's there on display. Now, the virtual museum is an online museum that we launched in January in partnership with the Google Cultural Institute. And that's an important partnership because our goal is to provide all of the information about the mission so that individuals can actually learn as deeply as they would like to learn about both the science and the engineering and the human lessons from the Viking mission. And so we've put up one introductory exhibit, which is really a very high-level view of Viking. And if you search if you look at the Google Cultural Institute Viking Preservation Project, you can see our first exhibit. But that exhibit will be followed by many, many others that drill down into things like images of Mars. And we have 3 wonderful people who have contributed their work, one of whom is a Viking graduate student in France, and another gentleman who has been reproducing the images, and we'll talk about the color of Mars, et cetera. And then we'll go down into the engineering, and there's already some engineering documents that you can see in detail. So you can look at the Viking meteorology instrument specification and see how it was done. Build your own Viking meteorology instrument. It's all there. We'll continue to add more.
So you go to Google Cultural Institute and then look for the Viking Project?
Yeah, the Viking Preservation Project.
Right, the Viking Preservation Project.
Yeah, it seems if you don't put the word preservation in, which is why our name is so long, you end up with the Minnesota Vikings or the Vikings from the Norlands.
Okay, so you need the preservation line in there as well.
Yeah, and there's a link on that website to the museum.
Yeah, there's a link on our the VikingPreservationProject.org to the actual exhibit.
But the actual, I'm still trying to get this clear in my mind. So the actual exhibit in Seattle is the Viking lander.
It's the Viking flight ready lander, correct?
Okay, and then everything else is virtual.
Everything else is virtual, and we are beginning next year the fundraising to actually enhance the physical exhibits with digital multi-touch screens, so you'll be able to walk up to various museum exhibits about Viking and interact with them and see much, much more deep content, hear interviews with the Vikings from the oral histories we've done, et cetera. But we're beginning the fundraising for that now. We actually have the exhibits designed conceptually, and we just are beginning the fundraising process next year for that.
Have you found that of the early missions that the United States and NASA and all of this did, that Viking has the most interest, or is there any way you can tell what of the early missions seem to, and I'm not including Apollo, obviously, but aside from Apollo, we're talking about, you know, non-human spaceflight missions. What grabs the attention of people the most? Is Viking it?
I think it depends. Al, I'll follow your answer if you have an answer.
I don't have an answer. I don't have a sense of how the public reacts.
Well, I can share with you what I've learned from the outreach that we've done already. So I go and talk to schools, and other Vikings have also done the same thing, doing outreach. And I always ask the question before we begin our talk, you know, what are the missions that you know about? And that could be first grade or 12th grade or graduate students. And I tend to do it in the grocery store because this is kind of my project too. Like, what's the earliest mission you've heard of? Honestly, I think the neurological science has already proven that you have to see it three times, right, before you remember it. And these days, the schools are simply not integrating any of the historic information from our missions that they could be. So the curriculum that's being developed, even with the core curriculum, is not including any of this material, which is why we are actually developing curriculum to fit the core standards that can be used by teachers, because there is math that can be learned by Viking. There is astrophysics that can be learned by Viking. There is material sciences. There's chemistry. There's biology. There's all these things that can be learned through the lens of Viking. But honestly, the missions that people seem to remember now are the ones that have happened most recently. People have a pretty short attention span in general. If it didn't happen in the last, 11 years, people tend to forget that it happened. And if NASA and the agencies are not talking about it, it will be forgotten. And that's why we started our project, because it is being lost, unfortunately. We'll change that. We are changing it.
Do you both support humans going to Mars sooner rather than later?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think it needs to be a combined robotics and human mission. I think there's things that humans do better, and there's things that robots do better, and it needs to be a combined mission. I think it's kind of silly when people say it should be one or the other. Al, what do you think? You're the rocket scientist.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, what you want is the adaptability of the human, and the pattern recognition and problem-solving capability and fixing things. But you also want to give them robotic tools so that they're very productive while they're there.
Yep.
I have another email, and this is for you, Rachel. I guess it's for you. From Burton Chan, who is in Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, what payload fairing diameter size did the Viking rover require? Of course, it wasn't a rover, but so what did the I guess we're going to our this is your responsibility for today, is to make sure we realize Viking was stationary and was not roving around, at least not purposely. What was the payload fairing diameter?
You know, I have to tell you that I am more the generalist than I am the specifications person, but I could look it up and tell you at some point. So send the question to me and I'll answer it in offline after the show. How about that?
Okay.
But Al may be able to answer it.
Well, you know that there was very little room between the outside diameter of the lander and the fairing, because you can't really afford very much. But and it had to be enough wiggle room so that it wouldn't hit the sides. But how big it was, I don't know. If the lander was, 12 feet across, then the fairing internal diameter was not much more than 12 feet.
Probably it used up all the space, I would imagine.
Yeah, it was interesting because when you... one of the things that was critically important was that there was not a lot of movement in the capsule, in the orbiter capsule, when the lander was encapsulated. And so the struts that actually, the pyrotechnics, that were involved in separation of the lander from the orbiter in that process, the entry process, entry and descent, meant that there couldn't be a lot of added weight, and so it was very close, as Al said. And I'm sitting here thinking that it was just inches, because the pyrotechnics, and I'm thinking in my head about one of the images of the lander, the pyrotechnics were just a few inches, were actually part of the aeroshell itself, and when those fired and the cuts were essentially made to separate the lander, they were within inches, you know, just a few inches. But I can't give you a technical answer. I'm just sort of talking while I think reflectively on some of the images. But I have the information, and we could certainly find that answer for you.
Well, I may find it on the web real quick before we end the show. I'm sure it's plastered in a lot of places.
Yeah, and I've got the Viking as-built document here too, so I could probably look it up. But it's hard to look things up and listen at the same time.
Absolutely. Do you think I've heard people talk about wanting to repeat the labeled release experiment and some of the other stuff on Mars, given today's science. Do you think that would be useful, or have we evolved past the science of what was on Viking?
I think that whenever you go to... Well, that's an interesting question. You, in science in general, one of the things that you want is baselines. So you want to do the same, to some extent, which means you want to do the same thing over and over in different places to create baselines. Is it the same in one place as it is in another? Well, obviously on Earth it isn't. If you land in the desert, it's quite desert-like. If you land in the rainforest, it's entirely different. So you want to do some of the same stuff again in different places. But that's one of the key things. So you want to go to different places and do the same thing. And I don't mean necessarily the precise same thing, but in order to get a good baseline standard, you actually do want to be as close to doing the same thing in each place. But you also, in another mission, would need to ask different questions that we didn't have the ability to ask on Viking. So I think you really need to do both. You need to create some baselines by asking some of the same questions. But the science has progressed well beyond where we were on Viking, and we need to ask some very different questions than were asked on Viking as well.
So you would be talking about different experiments and different equipment?
Similar experiments in some cases, and also new experiments. So we need to add to the baseline, but also ask new questions.
There is a gas chromatograph or spectrograph on a couple of the current rovers, right?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, there are.
And they have tested for the molecular composition, at least
Correct.
Atomic. But I think it's molecular weights, too. So in a way, they are continuing to redo these experiments.
Some of them, correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not all of them, but some of them, yes.
Fascinating.
We could do more of them. I mean, I actually think that we could do more different experiments than we have done. More that we're looking for extant organics as well as the indicators of the last of past organics.
Of course, the problem is the funding always.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, and the payload too. I mean, if you think about it, the lab that was used, the lab that the Viking biology experiments were based on Earth. I mean, the Earthbound lab was, you know, a few human rooms big, and on any lander or rover vehicle, it has to be a shoebox. That's how it was referred to by the Vikings frequently. Fit an entire room in a shoebox. So that's an immense challenge. And the smaller things get, the more expensive they tend to get. And it's difficult to get the funding to do all of the different experiments that were done on Viking again. Viking was the last cost-plus project that was done, and that meant that if it needed more money to make it work, more money was found. That does not happen today. And so the scientists on the missions today have a big challenge in that they are not going to get additional funding for an experiment that's defined beyond what they initially ask for very easily. So the scientists today have a lot of challenges on their hands, and I think they're doing a tremendous job with what they have, frankly.
Totally. But I wish it weren't that way, right?
Yeah. Oh, gosh, yes. You know, and I think that's a grassroots problem. I think that we need to communicate more, and we need to communicate better. We need to create access to the incredible things that are being done by, you know, the MER and MSL teams, by MAVEN, we need to do a better job at bringing the Mars experiments and the Mars challenges to Earth and connecting students with them. I think if we connect the kids and the teachers to those, like happened during Viking and happened during Apollo, we will be able to fund the projects better.
What should we have asked you about today that I've forgotten about or omitted or that should have been talked about, but we haven't yet talked about it? What would you have liked to have said that we haven't said yet, either one of you or both of you?
Al?
The only thing I'm thinking of was that the Chinese are probably going to be doing a lot of hits on the Viking Museum.
probably.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of other folks too, we hope. I mean, it's a learning process. Oh, you know, the collaboration is so important. I think that if I can jump in, during the Cold War, you know, Viking happened during the Cold War, and everybody talks about it, about Apollo and Viking as the space race. But what they don't recognize is that was a very political experience. And what the public doesn't necessarily know is that on the back end, behind all the politics and the journalism that was going on, the sensational journalism about the Cold War and the, you know, Soviets versus the U.S., behind all of that were incredible men and women in the Soviet Union and in the United States, and there are incredible people in China and in Mexico and in Europe and nations all over the world that were working together to do this. We have letters between the teams, the Mars 3, 4 teams, and Jerry Sofen. When Mars 3 and 4 were launched, they were communicating with Jerry Sofen, the chief scientist, about what they were discovering and what was happening and what the status was. And they were scientists. They cared about the same thing. They're all about discovery and exploration and learning and sharing and collaborating. And I think that is something that needs to be taken away and replacing some of the headlines about the differences between our nations. That's my personal opinion. I think we have a lot more in common between the individuals than we have differences. Everybody looks up at the same sky at night.
Well, unless they're in the southern hemisphere.
Okay, that wasn't exactly accurate.
couldn't resist that.
A little philosophical there.
Well, I do have a lot of New Zealand and Australia listeners, so I'm just trying to protect
their
interests.
Oh, my gosh. You know,
I'm surprised I haven't heard from them today.
Well, and I think that, I'm completely reticent in talking about that, but the mission was global in a million different ways, but one of the ways that is almost never talked about, and I should have mentioned it other than just generally and philosophically, but Viking would not have been successful without the work of the men and women in Canberra and Madrid. So there were people on the ground in Canberra and Madrid that were guiding the craft and that were communicating through the tracking stations to JPL Mission Operations to make sure that everything was as it needed to be. We would not be successful without people all over the world. There were scientists and academics and engineers all over the world that were supporting Viking, and people don't know that. But as we make more material public, hopefully people will recognize that. Viking was absolutely a global mission.
Something that we were experiencing during the mission was communicating with the Russians. We had pictures on the board there of their Venus lander. We were so proud of them for being able to do Venus in detail. They were unable to do Mars, but we could do Mars.
Yep.
So during that mission, and we also had, we had a Lunokhod Russian group come and give a presentation in Von Karman Auditorium. And it was kind of funny because when we were able to ask questions, they would look off at their handlers on the side and, gently deflect the questions.
Or answer if they were.
This was the Cold War, and they were not allowed to say or talk about certain things. So although the people themselves, we worked nicely with them.
Fascinating.
Yeah, when you take away the handlers and the politicians, everybody on the ground is working for the same thing. And when they do get together, it's incredible.
I still have. I worked with Georgi Shashkov on the space station. He was responsible for GNC on the Russian part of the space station, and I was basically the interface for the U.S. side. So after a while, he fell in love with a Russian translator and decided that he needed to come to the U.S., and I helped him change his, make his resume sound good. And it turned out we couldn't hire him on the space station because he was still a Russian, and we couldn't talk to him about certain things because of the State Department. So he got a job at doing software in California, and we still exchange Christmas wishes.
Terrific. Well, space is much more of a uniting force than it is of a divisive force.
Absolutely.
So we should keep that in mind.
Absolutely.
Any closing comments, pearls of wisdom that you would like to give us from either of you or takeaways other than what we've talked about?
Al?
Ad Astra.
Al goes first.
Ad Astra, to the stars.
Say again?
Ad Astra.
Oh, okay.
I said it in Latin.
You know, I would like to say that all of the missions that happen take collaboration and teamwork. And to me, that's the lesson that I've learned from all of the men and women that worked on Viking that I've spoken to. They worked like a family, and they worked through their differences like a family, supporting each other, arguing, but coming together at the end of the day to do what was right for the mission. And I think that that's something that we can all learn from. And I think that the lessons of aerospace missions like Viking translate into everyday lessons too. They're how do we work well together? How do we communicate effectively? How do we persevere? How do we ask the right questions? And how can we be humble enough to recognize that we don't have all the answers? It's about teamwork. Viking was an incredible team, and every person that I have interviewed and talked to thinks of Viking as family. So that's my big takeaway, is it happened because of every single individual.
One more email just came in. I'll go ahead and read it, okay? This is Ted in San Diego, and he says, do you have a store for Viking T-shirts?
Yes, we do. Well, we don't have a store, but we do have Viking T-shirts, and we haven't actually put the e-commerce piece up, but we do actually have them. So,
what is your website? How do they find them?
So the website is thevikingpreservationproject.org.
Okay.
So that's
Yes, all of those words.
I know, all of those words.
You need all of those words, right. Okay, and they can find it eventually there, correct?
Yes, eventually it will be. The e-commerce piece will be up, but yes, we do actually have T-shirts already, and we have more in production, and those are being used for fundraising for the exhibit. So, when we get our e-commerce app up on our website, there'll actually be a lot of pretty cool stuff that we're designing that will be available, and the funding will all go towards getting Viking out to all of the places that don't have access to it today.
Okay. I want to thank you both for being with us and for excusing our power outage for a couple of weeks ago when we were originally going to do this show. Well worth the wait. And Rachel, great work you're doing, and this has really been fun and informative and a great program, but more than that, it's pretty terrific what's going on. And Al, your memories of the project and what you've had to say have really added to the program. I want to thank you for being with us, both of you.
Well, you're welcome.
Thank you for having an incredible show, David. It's a lot of fun, and it's definitely been an honor.
Well, and we'll have to do it again. So what do you have planned for the 41st anniversary?
Well, actually, we may be in Mars, Pennsylvania, or we have a couple of plans. Well, keep your eyes on our Facebook page. That's where we do we blog on our Facebook page. So we'll let you know what our plans are next year, and we would love to come back, and we'll get more Vikings on as well.
You should, should have worked with the Mars Candy Bar Company to get a picture of Viking on their candy bar wrapper.
I'll tell you a funny story about Mars Candy Bar in another conversation. There's a funny story about Hershey.
That's who makes Mars Candy Bar?
Yeah, I think it's the Hershey Company.
Okay. All right, Rachel and Al, thank you very much for being on the program. And listeners, we're back with a full week of programming except for Sunday. We're off Sunday and Monday for the July 4th holiday. So everybody have a great rest of the weekend and a good week coming up. Thank you for participating and listening. Special thanks to Rachel and Al for a terrific program. And all of you have a great week. Goodbye from the Space Show.